KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
If you sit and ask the question, when was that building built? Why does it look the way it does? Why is the street as wide as it is? Why are there businesses on this part of the street? Why aren't there businesses? That's like a kind of an invitation to explore that world around you and also bigger questions.
When it comes to Mahler, it's the strangest thing because this is really intensely emotional and powerful music. And the kids, the students, they're young men and young women. They love that real raw emotion.
And we didn't get anything like that from the other side, the other Senate and Republican proposal. Given that they're going to have control of the Senate and control of the committee, I mean, I'm not sure what they're going to do.
Today on Weekday, we're going to explore the urban environment with urbanologist Max Grinnell. Art of Our City and Marcy Silman takes us inside the work of Stephen Radcliffe, talking about teens in the orchestra. We're also going to talk about television. We're going to talk about much more today on the program. But we're going to start with the Joint Task Force on Education Funding. You just heard State Senator David Frocht. He represents the 46th Legislative District. He was a member of that task force. December 31st was the deadline for that Joint Task Force to submit their proposal for a reliable way to fund education in Washington State. Now the new legislative session gets ready to begin. There will be the proposal on the table, but Republicans will be in charge in the Senate. So I asked Dave Frocht, what becomes of the proposal?
Well, there's two components to it. There's an adopted spending proposal, which lays out what the investment is supposed to be in this biennium and then over the subsequent two bienniums. And then there are a series of options for the legislature to look at for funding, and they include drawing down some of the rainy day fund for the initial part of it, looking at property tax issues. We've got potentially capital gains is mentioned in here. There's a series of options that were laid out, and the legislature is going to have to evaluate what they want to do. And, of course, there's a minority report that offers no spending cuts or revenue alternatives. They want to fund solely through existing resources.
Did you find anything in that minority report that you think Democrats and Republicans can work on?
Well, I think that, actually I did. And let me explain. It's a little bit of inside baseball. But the House Republicans had representation on the committee. The Senate Republicans had representation on the committee. The House Republicans at least came forward with a proposal. And their proposal would spend about $950, almost $1 billion. And they sequence their spending a little bit differently. But the one thing I can say is they actually put forward a proposal. And we didn't get anything like that from the other side, the other Senate, a Republican proposal. And given that they're going to have control of the Senate and control of the committee, I mean, I'm not sure what they're going to do. I think they're going to propose additional reforms, and we'll have to see what those will be. But I think actually that this process actually did a good thing, because we have essentially in the first year spend between $1 billion and $1.4 billion basically agreed to. And the sequencing is a little bit different, but those are problems that I think can be worked through.
State Senator David Frocht represents the 46th Legislative District. Now, the Joint Task Force on Education Funding was put together to answer the question that then was reiterated by the Supreme Court, which was that Washington State is not meeting its constitutional obligations to fund education. And then the court has not been impressed so far with what actions have been taken by the state. What do you think, having sat on this committee, needs to be in place to get a solid game plan going forward?
Well, Steve, we put together the game plan. Okay, that was a big part of what this task force did. We put together the spending plan over the next three biennia about what should be the way that we invest the dollars that need to be invested to fully fund. And I would remember the Supreme Court said in the McCleary opinion that if fully funded, the reform packages that were previously passed would rectify the funding problem in the K-12 system. So that was our task, and we have put together a plan for the legislature potentially to implement. And it lays out a series of spending proposals for education, the way that we would invest dollars in things like K-3 class size reduction, implementing full-day kindergarten, making sure that the state is picking up the share that it's supposed to pick up for maintenance and supplies and operational costs for the school districts that now are attributed to local levies. That's a big part of what this proposal does. And we've come up with a plan in the first biennium that by a 7-2 vote, with two members not voting, would invest $1.4 billion in education in the first biennium, and then it ramps up to additional spending over the next two to fully implement what we've already passed. And that's what our task was to do.
Now, you mentioned that there is a change of leadership in the Senate, and it looks like rather than you co-chairing a new education funding committee, that the state Senate might not even want to see a new education funding committee. What are you seeing right now, and what will be who will be the advocates on the Republican side?
Well, first of all, there's going to be an education committee, and there's going to be a Ways and Means Committee, and that's traditionally, you know, our education finance committee that we had proposed before two of our members switched over and decided to caucus with the Republicans was going to be a mechanism to try to address this issue and potential additional reforms that may be required. What we're going to have now, it looks like, assuming, because I think they are going to be have a slim majority and will be setting up the structure, is an education committee and a Ways and Means Committee that will then provide the funding. And I think they will work together to come up with a proposal. You know, I think the chair of that committee is going to be Senator Lizzo, and he's a good guy. He's got some difference of opinion with some of us on the Democratic side, but he's someone I think we can work with. But the key thing I want to see is what is their proposal, because he was on the committee, and there was another a member of the Republican Party on the committee, the Republican Senate on the committee, and at the end of the day, we didn't get any kind of full-on proposals from them about how they would accomplish this end. And then we talked a lot about reforms and what that would mean, and we need additional accountability, and I think those are all things that we should work together on. But I do think at the end of the day, money is a part of this, and we've got to figure out where we're going to go. And I didn't see anything, and they just, did not participate in the last part of the committee process, and so they didn't have any input into this report.
If ideas like this are to move forward, who needs to carry the ball? Is this now in the governor's court as the chief Democrat, or is this something that leadership can push forward to with the public as it goes forward?
I think the public recognizes, Steve, that this is probably the most important funding challenge we have coming into the new session. And you are going to have a state House of Representatives that I think is committed to implementing these proposals in some way. And I think you're going to have a Senate that also wants to do this. But the question is, how do you do it? We're going to have to come together and figure out a funding proposal that makes sense, that doesn't devastate everything else in the budget. And I'm interested to see how the new Republican majority in the state Senate handles those questions, because you can just say, you know, you can lay out kind of platitudes about, well, we need more reform and more accountability, and I think we should be open to those ideas if they're good ones. But I also think the Supreme Court is very clear. We have to fund what we've already passed. That's what this is about, funding the basic education formula that was the education reform for 2 or 3 years ago. That's what we're trying to do.
How do you think this joint committee worked in terms of reaching out across the aisle and also in terms of transparency? Was it a transparent process?
Yeah, I do think it was transparent. I think we had public testimony at every hearing. We heard from a lot of different stakeholders in the process. We had, I think, very compelling staff work done to really lay out what the choices were and what actually was called for in the process. There were not a lot. There were really very few, you know, behind closed door meetings. If that's your question, I think it was a pretty open process.
That's State Senator Dave Frocht, representing the 46th Legislative District, a member of the Joint Task Force on Education Funding. The task force was charged with coming up with funding formulas for fully funding education in Washington State. Now that proposal has been submitted, the Republicans will be in charge of the Senate. State Senator Steve Litzau looks to be under running the education committees. He was also a member of the task force. We hope to talk to him about what he sees happening next. Speaking of transparency in the legislative process, the Washington Policy Center has been trying for the past few years to make Olympia more transparent under its ideas. They've advocated for changes that would require more public notice, ban the use of title-only bills. Their proposals have been supported by the state attorney general, a Republican, the state auditor, a Democrat. Newspapers around the state have come out in support of more transparency. Jason Mercier is director of the Center for Government Reform at the Washington Policy Center. Jason, thanks for joining us again.
Steve, thanks for having me on.
What's the problem with the legislature?
Well, the problem is the senator mentioned a good process. That education funding task force had multiple meetings that involved the public, a lot of opportunity for public comment. So that's the way you'd like to see legislation come about. Unfortunately, what happens all too often in Olympia is what we saw happen in D.C. this past week, where the major tax bill was voted on hours after it was introduced. Nobody really had a chance to look at those 150-plus pages of changes to the U.S. tax code. Or what happened last year in a very controversial manner in Michigan, where on the same day a right-to-work bill was introduced, it was passed by both bodies of their legislature with no opportunity for public comment or involvement. And unfortunately, those national examples happened here in the state of Washington as well. And one example would be the bill last year to change the teacher evaluation process. And that resulted in the Washington Education Association putting out an alert to their members basically saying, you know, forget the schoolhouse rock jingle about how a bill becomes a law, because in Olympia it's done behind closed doors and all that's missing is the smoke-free or the cigar smoke rooms. If you look at the legislature's rules on transparency and involving the public, they're very good. They require 5 days' notice. They require an opportunity for people to come in and comment and testify on the bills from all corners of the state, whether you're in Bellingham or Spokane, Walla Walla, Olympia. But unfortunately, those rules are waived all too frequently. And what you'll see happen is on the same day a bill is introduced, or a title-only bill, which is essentially a blank piece of legislation whose sole purpose is to circumvent the constitutional restriction that bills don't be introduced prior to 10 days before cutoff, or the end of session, rather. This happens to where they'll put through legislation. The lobbyists know what's going on, but the public does not and doesn't have a chance to comment.
Your example in terms of lobbyists knowing what's going on was this education bill. The details, despite only 2 hours' notice of a hearing on blank bills, this was in an op-ed you wrote. Many education special interest groups were all too ready to testify on the details of this mysterious bill, and these details later appeared as amendments. Is that what you stick by? That that's what happened. That they seem to have a heads up. The general public did not.
Yeah, so what you'll see happen is this is where the public is behind the eight ball on this. Let's say that the legislature will give you the 5 days' notice of a public hearing. So you're going to take time out of your day. You're going to get time off of work, and you're going to go to Olympia to testify on a bill. Well, by the time you get there and they actually hold that hearing, chances are they may not even be holding comment on that bill that was introduced. Instead, it could be a striking amendment or a substitute bill that wasn't made available before the hearing, and the only ones that know the details of that bill are the lobbyists that helped write it. That really does not provide an opportunity for the public to be involved in this process. And to make matters even worse, what they'll do again is sometimes use what they call these title-only bills. These are vehicles that they keep out there in case they pass a cutoff or they get too close to the end of session, so they're able to attach language to it that people haven't had a chance to see yet. And what we really would like to see happen is, if this is supposed to be a process that involves the public in the drafting of the laws that we have to live under, and the opportunity for us to really know, not only the public, but for members, the legislators, to know what they're voting on. Because what happens all too often, especially on the budget bills, you'll have these 300, 400-plus page appropriation bills dropped on the bar hours before they're required to vote on them. Nobody has a chance to read those. So we'd like to just see some common sense protections put into place to where you actually have to give adequate public notice, you have to provide the details of what you're actually voting on, and at the end of the day, we don't want to see what happens in D.C. or in these other states. You shouldn't pass a bill before people have a chance to read it.
Now, you have introduced these reforms in the past. They haven't passed. Who's opposed them?
The closest that we've come to getting this implemented was Senate Bill 5419, and that was introduced in 2011. It only would have applied to budget and tax bills. So while that is a step in the right direction, since those are very omnibus bills and have big impacts on the state's economy, we'd like to see the protections extended to all legislation. It had a hearing in the Senate. The state auditor and the attorney general came to testify in support of it. Representatives, citizens from Eastern Washington came over and saying, you know, you need to give us some time to comment on this legislation, but it never made it out of committee. It never went to the floor. I'm not sure why that obstacle exists. I don't know if it's the leadership who is concerned that it might undercut some of their power because things would be more out in the open and less behind closed doors. I'm not really sure what the obstacle is, but I have to imagine if it ever got to the floor of the House and the Senate, it'd be hard to see the elected officials voting against their constituents' ability to participate in the process.
Jason Mercier directs the Center for Government Reform at the Washington Policy Center. They'd like to see legislation introduced to make the legislature more transparent and not to circumvent its own stated rules. Now you have, it looks like, we'll have Republicans controlling the Senate this time. Do you have a sponsor in the Republican side in this upcoming session for your proposals?
Well, if we look back to Senate Bill 5419, among the sponsors of that were Senator Sheldon, who, although he's a Democrat, sounds like he is going to be in leadership in the new Senate, as well as several of the Republicans, Senator Honeyford, Holmquist, Newberry, Benton, and Delvin. So there were some Republican sponsors for this, but it really isn't a partisan issue. If you look back to what happened last year during the Ninth Order drama, where in the Senate the Republicans were able to take over the floor and bring a budget bill directly to the floor without anybody having a chance to read it, that was a very bad process as far as trying to vote on a budget. And you saw many of the Democratic senators who were unaccustomed to having this process put on them cite our transparency recommendations and say we really shouldn't be voting on things we haven't had a chance to read yet. So my hope is this will not be a Republican or Democrat issue. It just will be a good government issue to help make sure everybody has a chance to know what's happening in Olympia and be a part of the process.
We've heard lawmakers defend the status quo. They say, look, we're a part-time legislature. Time is short. We introduce these title-only bills because we want to get place markers in place so that we can work more efficiently and effectively on the bills. They say they make a great effort to hear from the public. They're, you know, the critics say you're going to slow down the process, make it less transparent, and muck it up.
Well, when you think about legislation that's changing, whether it be regulations or environmental protections or tax and budget policy, you don't want this to look like a NASCAR race where everybody is racing to the finish line and has no chance to see what they've actually done. Even though there's still going to be the sausage making, there's still going to be the horse trading, there's still going to be a lot of backdoor conversations. You prefer this to be a more deliberate process to where you don't see simple mistakes being made and the public actually having a chance to see what their lawmakers are doing on their behalf. I understand why they like to have these vehicles. It makes it easier for them to try to get through what they want to get through. But at the end of the day, it is the public's body making laws for the public, and the public should be part of that process.
Jason, the Washington Policy Center bills itself as a group that is improving lives through market solutions. That's on your webpage. And I'm looking for the Trojan horse here. Where is the WPC's free market agenda coming into play with this proposal?
Well, part of, well, that's the overall goal for the Washington Policy Center. The Center for Government Reform also focuses on open government issues and governance issues. So I guess you can look at it from the standpoint of wanting to know what's in the various business regulatory bills, the various tax bills, the various budget bills, to make sure that you're pursuing free market policies. That could be an aspect of it, but this really isn't a left-right issue, a free market, or I don't know if there's an anti-market group, but it really is just a matter of good governance to where you have a chance to actually know what's occurring, avoid the easy mistakes, and have a really open public dialogue on what is being debated in Olympia.
All right, sir. We'll watch the process with you. I appreciate you taking the time.
Great. Thanks for having me on, Steve.
Jason Mercier is the director of the Center for Government Reform at the Washington Policy Center, talking about advocating for proposals for more transparency at the Washington State Legislature. Speaking of transparency, I have to apologize to you for passing on some bad information yesterday when we were talking about the Kuluk and that rig running aground. I read from what I thought was a Shell Oil website, But I was punked. I was hoaxed. I saw a hoax site that some people have put together, and I passed on to you their bad information. You can search around the web and find the real site and the fake site, but I apologize to you for giving you bad information. We're going to talk about walking through the cities. That's coming up. This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:25. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle University's Albers School of Business and Economics, offering graduate business degrees for working professionals and executives, including the MBA and two leadership EMBAs. Details on monthly information sessions at seattleu.edu/albers.
KUOW and Benaroya Hall present National Geographic Live, featuring speaker Enric Sala's Pristine Seas, Exploring Underwater Edens, January 13th through the 15th. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
We have sunny skies and 35 degrees in Seattle's University District, working towards a high of 43. We're expecting sunny skies all day. It's going to be cloudy tonight, chance of evening rain, rain increasing overnight, the low in the upper 30s. We're expecting clouds again tomorrow with a chance of rain in the morning, tomorrow's high in the mid-40s.
What makes a great city is the sum of its parts, but what really makes a great city is when the parts exceed the sum. Max Grinnell is an urbanologist. He studies cities. Just what does that mean, urbanologist Max Grinnell?
It's really someone who's interested in all facets of urban life. It could be the transportation systems of a city, studying where do people live within cities and why, what attracts people to cities, and what has really driven cities, people to cities from rural or suburban areas for hundreds of years, really millennia.
Max Grinnell teaches writing and urban studies at the Massachusetts College of the Art of College of Art and Design. He has also written some books for the Rough Guide series, including the cultural and historical aspects of Florida, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota. I guess they all have cities. Do those states have great cities? Florida, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota?
They do. And if you were to look at kind of, I think, mainstream media and media depictions of these places, you would get kind of a broad, largely inaccurate stroke of what these places are like. What is a great city in Indiana? I had never been to Indianapolis.
What is a great city in Indiana?
I would go Indianapolis. I mean, it's a place that I've had. I went out there to work and write about it for Rough Guides. And, you know, my initial kind of thought was, well, it's going to be completely sprawly. There won't be the kind of density or diversity that I really thrive on. And a lot of people thrive on when they come to visit a great city. And they do have that. They have the broad ripple area of Indianapolis is a great walkable residential community. And I think in a lot of these places, especially Florida, which no one associates with great walking cities, maybe St. Augustine, but you really have to kind of get out there and kind of do the exploring on your own. I mean, for example, to come to our interview today, I walked from my childhood home in East Lake Avenue, around University Bridge, came up the Ave. I mean, and I saw stuff I've seen. I've done that walk hundreds, if not thousands of times as a child.
All right, so why has Eastlake got a good walking feel for you? Because a lot of people look at Eastlake as a corridor, and they don't see it as a place where people not just walk, but where people are living and trying to, you know, be in a neighborhood.
Right, and it's basically a place to get to someplace else quickly, right? Having lived there from 1985 on, it was always an area, and I think a lot of young people like this, this is kind of how do you explore your neighborhood on foot when your parents say, I can go out for 15 minutes, you can go out for half an hour. To me, there's that personal history. I walk down East Lake Avenue and I think of the former bar supply store that used to be there. I think of all the...
Did you ever go in there?
I did go there once, and I inquired about large pots.
I mean, that's part of what makes a great city, right? That you can walk into a place like that. And
here you are. You're on foot. You don't have to think about parking. You don't have to think about the other kind of nuances, a freeway exit. You just walk, and you do. So I stopped into the bar supply place and asked about pots. When I was 15, I got into my head that I was going to open a coffee place in the future. But this was the, you know, the early 90s. So, I mean, whose dream wasn't this at the time? Like, who wasn't thinking about a coffee shop? And so for me, East Lake Avenue has this kind of variegated landscape, everything from massive 1960s apartment buildings to new condos from the last few years to Rogers Park. Really a lot to kind of discover and explore. And I think you can do it by foot.
All right. You wrote that. So you said some great walks, and you mentioned that one, walking up East Lake. 45th from Ballard to Laurelhurst.
It's a long walk.
Okay.
It's a long walk.
So I get you with chunk of Ballard. It's very urban, a lot of things to look at. And then you got to grunt up that hill.
Well, that's where we're getting – listen, Americans need more exercise. So that's where we're getting – that kind of huge – and I think even if you think of that, like that curve as you move along that street and kind of come up you know, from Ballard and then eventually to Wallingford, I think you're getting that kind of – that the pleasantness of a curve as you go around that bend, you see new things too, right? It's like a new vista that if you're on foot, part of it's revealed slowly.
Is that part of what
– Oh, so whereas if you're in a car, bam, 2 seconds, you're gone.
Is that part of what makes a great city is having things unveil, reveal themselves slowly?
Yeah, absolutely. If you think of great vistas, whether it's Michigan Avenue in Chicago, I would argue looking down some of the name streets in Seattle, like a Seneca, like a Madison, like a University, and even some of the number streets, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, like there are those different vistas. And you kind of just have to take the time to slow down and look. And I think as everyone does in 2012, how hard is it to take the time and slow down? Can be very hard.
Well, to what end? What's the value in me enjoying walking across Wallingford?
I think the value is that whether you are, you know, whether you are a small child, whether you're a teenager, whether you are elderly, is that you will learn something new about the way that a city works and feels. And the thing is, I always tell my students, if you are curious, you will never be bored with life. And for a city, and in cities, you can be curious all the time and find out all these new things. I suppose the value is it's geography, economics, planning, sociology, anthropology, architecture. But I think you got to take the time to do it. And I think that's something that we are all very hard pressed to do. And if we think about how do young people or how does anybody learn, it's through experience. So if you sit and ask the question, when was that building built? Why does it look the way it does? Why is the street as wide as it is? Why are there businesses on this part of the street? Why aren't there businesses? That's like a kind of an invitation to explore that world around you and also bigger questions. That's how it works for me anyways.
Max Grinnell is a geographer, historian. He writes and teaches about urban studies. So you handed me your cards, and on this, I want to get as gritty now. You handed me
Let's
a card, and on the front of this card is a Chicago sewer top. What is that?
That is a
manhole cover.
That is a manhole cover that is from Fullerton Parkway in the Lincoln Park community, and I saw that on a Monday morning. This is a couple years ago, and I took my camera and said, I need to get a picture of this because this is...
Why? What does this say to you?
Oh, this is part of the kind of the unseen kind of everyday world of cities that no one thinks about. Urban infrastructure, right? I mean, this is how, you know, where does this water go, right? I mean, some places it goes right into right into the water, right? You know, it could go into a Lake Michigan, could go into an Elliott Bay. And I always use these kind of moments when I'm out with my students or with friends, and friends can attest to this, to kind of say it's that closer look. It's like that slow down and say, how does this – something we take for granted in the 21st century that we're going to have this way for dirty water to exit the city. And I'm thinking, I was walking down Alaskan Way yesterday, and I was thinking about two of the big infrastructure challenges facing that part of Seattle right now, Alaskan Way Viaduct solution and the crumbling seawall, right? I mean, we take for granted that these things are public works projects, but what's that kind of, how can you start that conversation just through something as simple as a walk?
Well, Seattle takes pride in its manhole covers. It's turned them into works of art.
Right.
Even more so than they are works of art just by their virtue of their design. But what Does that tell you something about the urban space, how even the smallest bit of infrastructure is treated?
I think so. I've written and talked about public art and how it enhances our experiences in cities quite a bit. And this example in Chicago is kind of, you know, everyday, quotidian, pretty functional. But you point out, rightly so, that in Seattle we have the playfulness. What there might be a piece of Tlingit Native American art on a manhole cover. I saw a great one on Western Avenue the other day with faces and photos that have been put into the mix. I think they can enhance the world around us and give us an opportunity to kind of learn a little bit more about who we are as a community. And sometimes they are just that. They are just like functional objects.
Max Grinnell is an urbanologist, by the way. Is that a word you coined yourself?
It is, in fact, a dictionary word. I would love it if people thought I coined it, like I just, like a neologism, like I just threw it out of the air. But it is, in fact,
so,
a dictionary word.
A student of or specialist in urban problems. So what are you reading in the city that suggests solutions to problems? So what are some of the problems? For example, you walk down Aurora. You say Aurora is an interesting street to walk down from the 40s to the 80s, I think you said.
That's, you just named one of my favorite stretches.
All right. Not a walking street in many people's mind.
Definitely not a walking street. And if you think about it, as you know, it's part of the Washington State Highway system. Obviously, historically, where there are lots of low-rent hotels, motels, the kind of commercial uses that either people would once make moral judgments about, and they don't want them to be near anything else, schools, churches, etc. But I think walking those less pedestrian friendly environments is also a great way for us to learn about, like, what do we value in a city, right? Where are we going to put this stuff? People want this stuff, right? People want kind of cheap hotels, auto repair places, Jack in the Box, etc. Having said that, I've had some harrowing escapes on Aurora Avenue just because, by virtue of, you know, cars turning quickly. 80th and Aurora is a good. I've had a few harrowing escapes at the sidewalk there.
Gun store there too.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is a great place. I'm sure there's any number of fast food options right on those couple blocks.
But it's also a laboratory for small business because of those little mini malls. So what do we value with Aurora? Is Aurora a place that is looking at it as an urban problem? Should it be revamped the way they've tried to revamp it up in the Shoreline with trees and wider sidewalks and medians? Or is it something in time that we should value for what it is?
Mm. I think it is something in time that we should value. I think there are kind of those people, you know, in the urban design community, planning community, who look down upon these types of areas, right? And the thing is, if a city is diverse and dense as it should be, that makes a city interesting, the density, diversity, you're going to have those type of environments, right? People love their cars. Even in Seattle, which has great, you know, Burke Gilman, has great other bicycle trails, people do like their cars, and they like these kind of automobile-friendly environments as part of this.
Well, do you have an equivalent in – so you live in Boston now.
That's correct.
What's the equivalent of the far suburbs of Seattle, like Issaquah or the Highlands, or – we can come in a little bit. But I don't want to come all the way to Bellevue. I still want to keep it more Redmond.
Right.
Where it sprawls a bit, as we say, sprawls. Do you have an equivalent of that in Boston area?
You know, that's a great question as well. There isn't an exact equivalent. You know, one of the beltways that goes outside of Boston, which has been so successful with high-tech corridor development in the last 50 years, is Route 128. So once you get out past Route 128, you get the lower density developments that you might find further out, like around in Issaquah.
Well, is that an urban problem? Are those places with lack of density, are they an urban problem?
I don't think they're an urban problem as much as they are, you know, how do we kind of reconfigure the way we live in the 21st century for we have, you know, increased concerns about natural resource allocation, especially when it comes to oil and an automobile car friendly environment. How do we rethink some of these places? Now, if I were going to offer a solution, one of the solutions that's been in vogue in the last 25 years, we've seen it in Seattle, we've seen it certainly if you take Sound Transit down to SeaTac, is transit-oriented development, which is easy to do. If you have an area like Boston with the Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority, you can really reconfigure to make those areas around train stations quite dense. So you have that kind of partial solution. But you do have, you know, 15 miles outside of Boston, you will have that kind of low, even 10 miles outside of Boston, even like a Dedham, Massachusetts, you will have an older historic core, grew up around a commuter rail station, a stagecoach waylaid point, but you'll still have that sprawl, right? You'll go 10 miles, you'll find big box retail, you'll find all that stuff.
Well, Everett, Max Grinnell, or maybe to an extent, Olympia. What about those, and I don't mean that, or Paulsbo, I don't mean it, or Bremerton, I don't mean that as an insult, but as second-tier cities, in other words, not as big cities, those cities did sort of lose their walking cores. What's the solution for you?
How do you stitch it all back together?
Or if you need to, or is it just...
I mean, evolution. You know, this is the challenge of doing anything in any big city. I always tell my students and friends is the density and diversity presents tremendous opportunity. Not everyone in a diverse urban environment is really going to value a walkable environment. Some people say, oh my God, I don't want to walk anywhere. I want to drive every place. I want tons of, and I'll use air quotes here, free parking, because we know parking is not free. Automobiles are notably land use hogs. They bump out everything, and unless you get like an outlier like San Francisco, where they, God forbid, take away parking spaces, Boston take away parking spaces for pocket parks, it's hard to do. You know, you mentioned Everett, you mentioned the Olympias. It's also kind
of Aberdeen's another one too. I
spent many formative summers in Aberdeen. It's where my mother grew up, my mother's family grew up, and you know that. That presents a whole other set of urban problems, because what do you do when two major industries, logging and fishing, dry up, either through government regulation or through the fact that there aren't that many fish left?
Yeah, and yet the infrastructure for the urban area is still there.
Right. If you go to an Aberdeen, you go to a Hoquiam, you still have these fragments, right? And we're talking about stitching the fabric back together to make it walkable, to make it have that kind of vaunted qualities like of a Seattle, a San Francisco, an Austin. You name it, right? These places that are really popular. And part of the problem is these places are really popular. I mean, how do you replicate it in like Jacksonville, Florida?
Yeah, you're not walking downtown Aberdeen because you're going to the mall out on the outskirts of town.
Absolutely, right? Or you're going someplace else. I mean, this is the restructuring of the urban and suburban landscape since World War II around the automobile has created tons of opportunities. But it also creates problems as we think about what do we do in, as we approach peak oil, as we kind of reconfigure the way we want to spend time?
Well, they might just rebuild themselves, right? Those urban cores might rebuild because we'll be closer.
Yeah. And there's also the sociological question of, you know, I was reading an article a couple of years ago in The New Yorker about super commuters in Atlanta. So people spend over 60, 70 minutes on a one-way commute. What does that mean, time away from family? What does that mean? Maybe I'd like to write a book. Maybe I'd like to learn how to paint. This is, you know, time is in some sense a zero-sum game. You can't get it back.
All right, so what's your favorite walk right now in this town? If you were to tell people you really want to get a feel for how this city is working today, city of Seattle, since you're back here visiting your hometown, where do you, what's your route?
I mean, I'll have to give you two. Because, you know, I'd love to do one, but...
No, you can go two.
Okay, if I can go two.
You have a minute and a half.
Oh, okay, perfect. If I can go two, that's even better. I've always loved to think about the recent changes in Seattle. I've always loved First Avenue. I would say if you could walk First Avenue really from Belltown or maybe even Lower Queen Anne, you could walk it all the way down into Pioneer Square, all the way down into SoDo. You're getting a little bit of everything.
Well, what question would you ask as a historian, as an urban studies person? What question would we ask as we walk that?
I would ask the question, what are the industries, what are the key industries and the key people who have transformed this street? So it's both that question of agency in terms of like, you know, larger than life individuals who've been on the street, like historically, whether it's a Yesler, a Denny, and then also how has this place changed in the recent past, right?
And what's your other walk?
My other walk would most likely be, and I'll say it again, it would probably be East Lake Avenue. I'm gonna continue with that, and I'll say my own geographical bias because this is a neighborhood I grew up in. Walk East Lake all the way down back into downtown. you know, something even exciting just to be like to kind of do even some like the historic photographs to contrast how much that area has changed. That'd be a great walk.
Max Grinnell teaches writing and urban studies. He thinks about the urban environment, Massachusetts College of Art and Design. He is a former Seattle, what high school was it?
James A. Garfield High School.
James A. Garfield High School graduate, that's right. His most recent books have been for the Rough Guide series, looking at Florida, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, and a few others as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Weekday.
A rebuilt Jersey Shore might not have the same beachfront homes and roller coasters.
Is it going to look like people remember from their childhoods? No.
Town planners want the nostalgia, but not its vulnerability.
The next time a superstorm rolls through, we want to be able to pull down the hurricane shutters and wait for the power to come back on.
Host Sandy Planning, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and much more today from 3 until 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. Good morning, it's 9:45. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from Regents Blue Shield. Regents, your health connected. More information at Regents.com, serving select counties in the state of Washington, and an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
We have sunny skies and 35 degrees in the U District. We're expecting sun all day, the high getting up to 43. It's going to be cloudy tonight, chance of evening rain, rain increasing overnight, the low in the upper 30s. We're expecting clouds again tomorrow with a chance of rain in the morning, tomorrow's high in the mid-40s.
And now, the art of our city. Seattle area arts organizations have been celebrating big milestone birthdays this season. So, Marcy Silman, what, the Seattle Rep is 50?
Seattle Rep turned 50 or started its 50th season in September. Pacific Northwest Ballet is in the middle of its 40th season. But
40th.
Yeah, but Steve, there's an organization I bet you don't know as well that's a whole lot older than both of those two.
Oh, really?
Seattle Youth Symphony Orchestra, they call it SYSO. 70 years old, 7-0.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, so what's that, the 30s?
Yeah, 1942. Started in 1942.
And
you know, I've heard of them, and our colleague Dave Beck has worked with them. A lot of folks have played with Youth Symphony, and maybe you've even seen a performance they play. The top orchestra plays at Benaroya Hall, and they're really amazing kids. But I really didn't know much about them, so I invited the music director, Stephen Radcliffe, in to just get an idea what SYSO was.
Seattle Youth Symphony is the largest youth orchestra training program in America. We have over 1,700 students in four academic year orchestras. We have two summer music festivals and an extensive public school partnership program.
So who are the kids who are part of the program?
Well, they're all the way from fourth graders and fifth graders in West Seattle to middle school wind and brass students in our endangered instrument program to the students in our academic year program, which ranges from kids that are 7 years old all the way up to 21 years old, to the students that come from all over the country to study at the Maristone Music Festival in the summertime. And those kids are up to 25 years old.
I know that there are orchestras and bands in a lot of the schools in the Seattle area, but the kids who are in the sort of top orchestra of SYSO, who are they? How do they get to that pinnacle?
Well, we're very lucky. I mean, Seattle has this incredible amount of terrific musical talent, and that's thanks so much to the private studio instructors and the private teachers all throughout the region. But the kids that are in my orchestra, the top orchestra, the Seattle Youth Symphony, are really the best music students in the whole Puget Sound area. We have students that come down from Bellingham, students that come up from the Olympia and Tacoma area. So they come together on a Saturday morning, and we work for 3.5-4 hours every morning. And for most of the kids, and definitely for me, it is the high point of the week to stand in front of these amazingly talented and wonderful young people. It's such an honor and such a gift.
They're not all intending to be professional musicians, are they?
I hope not.
Not enough jobs for them?
Well, it's not only that. It's that, you know, our job is really to instill in these students a lifelong appreciation for symphonic music and the symphonic musical arts. And we expect, and it has been proven, that our students go on to be successful in a wide variety of careers. But I think the most important thing is that as they go on in their lives, they will become ticket buyers to their local orchestras and subscribers and donors and patrons and board members even. So many of them will carry with them a lifelong passion to playing musical instrument in a community orchestra or an amateur group. Many of them do go on to professional careers. But, you know, for us, it's most important that we're not only teaching the musicians of the future, but more importantly, the audiences of the future as well.
Well, clearly our audience can't see you, but you weren't around 70 years ago when this organization was founded. but you've been around for a while, and I don't know if you can. If you can, I'd like you to speak a little bit to how the mission of CISO has changed from 1942 when it was founded to,
sure,
to where,
well,
we are now.
In a broadest sense, and this is the case for most arts organizations, not only here in Seattle but throughout the country, you know, they've changed from entertainment organizations to community service organizations. The Seattle Symphony, the Pacific Northwest Ballet, the Seattle Art Museum, all of us have tremendous community service and education and community enrichment missions as well. And CISO is very much the same. We started off with just one orchestra under the conductor Francis Arani, who was the concertmaster of the Seattle Symphony at the time, and has grown now to four orchestras. But more importantly, what we're doing in the public schools to support instrumental music education there, to support the teachers who are doing a wonderful job, unfortunately, with limited resources. We're supporting that by adding to those resources, by bringing our teachers into the schools and working directly with the teachers there.
Were you approached by the schools, or did you approach them? How did that come about?
It was actually a very nice courtship, a terrific dance. My predecessor, Walter Cole, had created a marvelous program, which is called the Endangered Instrument Program. And so we send professional musicians into the schools to help kids transition from the instruments that are taught in the elementary school to those that are not taught and that are a little bit more unusual, but nevertheless are really important for our organization. To add to that, some years ago we received a Wallace Foundation Excellence Award, which allowed us to be very, very present in one specific vertically integrated core pathway of learning in the West Seattle area. So we started out in six elementary schools in West Seattle doing exactly that, bringing in teachers to help the classroom teachers build a really strong and robust program. And that's been just amazingly successful.
The intent isn't that those kids would necessarily come to CISO. It's just fostering the same kind of music opportunities, maybe,
exactly,
that some other kids might get.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, sure, the more students that we have, the more robust the cultural community is, the more parents are getting involved in seeing music as an important component of their child's overall education, not just an extracurricular activity, but something that's really vital in their child's life and then in their family's life. So as that happens, we're sort of hoping to change the culture here in Seattle and anywhere else that wants to hear of our program.
Big mission.
Yeah.
Well, how did you come to this type of work?
Well, I was a music director of some orchestras in the East Coast and worked in New York City and toured in Europe as well. I was music director of a chamber orchestra in Hungary. And then went to the Boston area, went back to the Boston area and became assistant conductor of the Boston Lyric Opera. And got a job teaching at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And really, I've been doing youth orchestras all my life, as most young conductors do. Their first jobs are with youth orchestras. But I started off with a music education degree from New England Conservatory. So I had a conservatory education, but still had an education degree. And those two tracks have been with me all my life.
So you've worked in, I was going to say, grown-up orchestras. You've worked with youth, and you've worked with adult musicians, professional musicians. Aside from the youth of the players in CISO, what do you get that's different working with kids, with teenagers, than you would with a group of professional high-caliber musicians?
Well, they're all so wonderfully incredibly technically gifted, but at the same time, to engage dramatically in the performance of Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, or to create the colors that one needs to play in Debussy's La Mer, for example, that we'll be performing later on, or the sort of gossamer light yet very crisp qualities of the Stravinsky Violin Concerto, which we performed in the last, all of those sort of qualitative and tactile things that are really challenge the students. It's not just where you put your fingers, it's not how fast you can play, but it's all of those more ephemeral things that challenges the student. If you say, play this with a more gauzy tone, or play this lighter and more like a ribbon, you're really engaging all of these cognitive functions in a student, as opposed to play faster, louder, slower, which is in many cases, unfortunately, what professional orchestras really require, is that sort of very fast learning.
A lot of this music is totally unfamiliar to the kids when they get it, a Shostakovich or even maybe Brahms. They might know the name, don't know the music. Is there an innocence that they bring to it? Is there something besides when you talk about gauziness or faster, louder? Is there something innate to how kids, aspiring, budding musicians approach something as opposed to people who do it for a living?
Yeah, you know what's really funny is not funny, but just it's so touching and so moving. Some years ago, we performed the Mahler Symphony No. 2, which is a great and magnificent work. And when it comes to Mahler, it's the strangest thing because this is really intensely emotional and powerful music. And the kids, the students, they're young men and young women. They're so excited about Mahler. Every year we read a Mahler symphony, of Mahler 6 last year, and we'll do something else this year. But they love that real raw emotion. I don't know quite how to articulate this. You know, teenagers are kind of emotionally bottled up, and they really want to express. They want to love. They want to sing. They want to suffer. They want to experience all these incredible emotions. But, you know, the social milieu of teenagerdom and high school sort of, in many cases, it's kind of restrictive. And as they grow into adulthood, they will become these wonderfully expressive and vibrant young people. Playing a Mahler symphony gives them that ability to act it out in a way that's safe.
We'll hear, certainly, and see members of Seattle Youth Symphony Orchestra this, the 70th anniversary year. Stephen Radcliffe is music director of the organization. Thanks so much for coming in.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And the Seattle Youth Symphony Orchestra is performing Sunday, January 13th at 3 p.m. at Benaroya Hall. You can find out more information by going to kuow.org. Last week, I asked you to help us get to 4,000 likes for our Facebook page. You know, we just have these goals that we set for ourselves, right? We all do, yes? How many friends do you have? Some of you probably have like thousands and thousands of friends on Facebook. We needed to get 4,000. You responded, and we made it. So now we have a higher goal, because I guess a lot of you said a higher goal would have been more fun. All right, fine. 6,000? 6,000, what, by the end of the day? 6,000 likes on our Facebook page by the end of the day. Ready, set, go.
And now, the sound of the day.
Well, you can tell it's a train, yes. That's the sound of the famous Durango and Silverton narrow gauge train arriving in Silverton, Colorado. Weekday listener Emery recorded this piece of 19th century technology with his 21st century technology, making a video of the train's arrival and then sending us the soundtrack. The train line from Durango to Silverton was built in 1881 to carry supplies to people working in the gold and silver mines in the San Juan Mountains. Now the line hauls tourists and has the distinction of being one of the few places in the United States where you can witness a steam engine in constant use. All aboard! Send us your sounds. Weekday at kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Your days are much more fascinating than you're giving yourself credit for. You work with machines, you have pets, you have children, you have odd things happening as you walk down the street and find some strange echo. There's this echo over on the University of Washington campus by the communications building. In the back of the communications building, there's a little courtyard, and in the center of the courtyard is a drain. If you stand directly over the drain and talk, it's like you're transported through time and space to another dimension. I recommend you do that. And then send us a sound of it. Stay with us. We're going to talk about television. We're going to talk about the life of the radio announcer. We're going to get a recommended lunch spot from Sarah Dickerman. And we're going to start off, turns out there's a big mall building boom in Russia. Russian malls. That's coming up on Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:59. We'll get an update from NPR News coming up next.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest Public Media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
Fracking has transformed America, but it's dividing the country as well. The new Matt Damon film, Promised Land, may stir even more passion on the subject.
It really asked more questions than it.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.